This is the Publix Radio. You're listening to the Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez. In the 2025 Rhode Island General Assembly, lawmakers passed a new major gun law and numerous bills tackling housing and health care. We'll look into what legislators achieved and failed to get done, as well as what to expect in 2026. Also, Trump administration policies are scaring off tourists. Hotels have higher than normal vacancies. Restaurants are closing on certain days due to low traffic. What kind of summer season will we have this year? And thousands in Massachusetts and Rhode Island will be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Cape Verdean independence this weekend. We talk with two people from our region who are being featured at a national celebration in Washington, D.C. That and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. The 2025 Rhode Island legislative session concluded last week. A ban on the sale of assault weapons garnered the most attention, but state lawmakers also passed various pieces of legislation intended to address the housing crisis and improve the state's healthcare system. Here to talk more about the Rhode Island General Assembly, what they did and what they didn't accomplish this year, is Providence Journal reporter Patrick Anderson. Patrick, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Always great to have you. Also joined by the politics and business editor at WPRI Channel 12, Ted Nisi. Ted, great to have you back.
Great to be back.
All right. Looking at this session, I'm just wondering, like, your biggest takeaways when you look at it compared to past years. What jumped out at you, Ted?
Well, the biggest surprise to me was how many taxes and fees were increased in the budget. I think because while we knew that federal funding is tapering off and that there were a lot of demands on healthcare, on housing, on other issues, I didn't necessarily expect them to say yes to so many of those requests and therefore create a need to raise more taxes and fees, all leading up to the governor's dramatic announcement that he would not sign the budget, but also allow it to still become law without his signature. So that was a surprising thing to me.
Patrick, what about you?
Well, to Ted's point, when Governor McKee came out and said that he opposed the gas tax increase especially, he kind of laid down the territory that's going to be the political discussion point for the next couple of months about that we have had a somewhat broad-based tax increase for the first time in a while, even if it's not huge. And then you have the Taylor Swift tax discussion, which is always a talker. It's changed the discussion, I think, a little bit from the last couple of years where there really haven't been much tax increases at all.
I would say that is a big one, but let's go to the actual one that got a lot of attention, of course, the assault weapons ban. And this is a scaled-back version of it. Patrick, what happened? What was going on that this is what we ended up getting?
I think the big takeaway is that the new Senate President, Val Lawson, and her majority leader, Senator Frank Chacon, were able to keep this new coalition together, this new coalition that made her Senate president and is not the most intuitive or obvious coalition. It has a bunch of different factions within it, and it bridges a wide ideological divide. But they were able to keep it together and assuage some of the concerns of the conservative members who are Second Amendment folks, and enough of them to go along with it and not get a complete rebellion from progressive lawmakers and supporters of gun control, to the point where I think a big thing where Rep. Jason Knight, the House sponsor, did not denounce it on the House floor and said it was better to pass than not pass.
You know, Ted, I'm wondering, though, if things didn't play out the way they did and we had a new Senate president, if this would have passed or not.
Well, you know, I think in a way this to me is the story of how Democrats have kept their supermajorities in the Rhode Island legislature for many, many decades, which is the leadership has this ability to keep the conservative Democrats on sides, do enough on the contentious issues to convince more left-leaning Democrats that they're making progress, but not so much progress that they totally lose the conservative Democrats, right? And this was a perfect example of that kind of compromise where the advocates badly wanted a full assault weapons ban, a ban on possession, and we thought, I think Patrick and I would agree, that we weren't sure there was any appetite for anything on assault weapons among some of the more pro-Second Amendment Democrats. But in the end, Val Lawson, the Judiciary Committee Chairman Matt LaMountain, figured out that a ban on sale and purchase of these could get through the Judiciary Committee. They could get Frank Chacon on board, the majority leader, who's a pro-gun guy. But if they push that over to the House, even though over in the House they'd also want a possession ban, that would pass and they could say they did something.
All right, I want to try to get to a couple of points here. They, of course, tackled the affordable housing issue, but did they do enough? Obviously, one of the things is the overall housing stock. Ted, I mean, Did we make any move on this?
You know, I do think there's a glass half full, half empty way to look at this. They've done an enormous amount. Or they've passed something like 50 bills, laws on housing. This is a topic Patrick knows very well. But on the other hand, I just watched the prices. And we just hit $500,000 for the median single family home in Rhode Island. So until you see them do, quote unquote, enough to actually make people's rent go down or make houses more affordable, I'm not sure the public's going to think all this legislative activity is really affecting them on the ground.
Oh, Patrick, especially you talk about rent too, and in Providence it's probably going to go up, but no, and yeah, housing now at over half a million.
They're doing a lot of very small incremental things that may or may not help, but at the same time, the market does not stop, and the larger economic forces in the country that are way bigger than Rhode Island don't stop, and that has to do with interest rates and the population and different demographic changes, and so that stuff usually overrides a lot of what happens on the regulatory side and the legislative side. So really, you have these high interest rates right now that don't show any signs of coming down. And that's going to make housing unaffordable no matter what they do. And it's going to make construction, which is what Joe Ciccarci is trying to get, much more difficult to do. So he can do a lot to try to ease the barriers for construction. But if builders can't get a loan, it's going to be tough to make that happen.
All right. We're facing a shortage of primary care doctors. Hospitals are in financial trouble right now. There's a lot here. But again, this is something lawmakers were trying to tackle, trying to respond to this issue. But Patrick, did they make any move on this whatsoever?
Yeah, they are putting a decent chunk of money into higher Medicaid reimbursement rates across a variety of different services, primary care being the first one, also hospitals, also nursing homes. It's very tough to predict what that is going to mean for can you get a doctor when you call up and you need one? But they have spent money. You can't accuse them on this one time of not spending money.
In a way, it's the same as the housing issue, right? It's like they are doing things and things that sometimes are hard for them for the leadership to get through. But that doesn't mean they're doing so much that it's going to actually impact people's lives on the ground. I think that's often the disconnect between the state house and regular people.
Add to that, now Trump's bill goes to the House. How would that impact healthcare in our state?
Well, I do think it's going to take a couple of years to be clear to everybody because a lot of the provisions in the bill don't come into effect, you know, the day he signs it. But if the scale of Medicaid cuts and health insurance subsidies cuts that are in this bill actually go through over coming years, I would expect the uninsured rate to go up. I would expect to see more demands for the state to backfill some of those programs, but the state doesn't really have the money to make up for what the feds are taking away. But I also think that's going to be played out in all 50 states, so I wouldn't be surprised if Congress takes another look at all this.
Real quickly, both of you, I wanted to ask, going into 2026, it's an election year. Patrick, how's that going to play things out?
Well, right now, I mean, you see Governor McKee trying to get ahead of things and kind of set the ground in a more favorable terrain for him and kind of scare Speaker Ciccarci away if he's thinking of running, which people assume he is. But that campaign hasn't gotten really going yet until someone else, Helena Foulkes, presumably announces and starts campaigning. It's still going to be in the background, a kind of shadow campaign.
Ted, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Patrick said it well. I think that's going to be very dominant. I think with Governor McKee's poll ratings so weak, you know, he's a ripe target. But I also know he's a very competitive guy who is probably going to stay until the end at this rate. That's certainly his intention.
I've been speaking with Ted Nesi, politics and business editor at WPRI Channel 12. Also, Patrick Anderson, reporter at the Providence Journal. Patrick, Ted, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Lewis.
We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch after this break.
I'm Ian Donis. I've hosted Political Roundtable since 2009. Having weekly in-depth conversations with the most interesting local leaders in Rhode Island. The program is going on a summer hiatus, but we're not going away. Roundtable will return soon with a new name and updated format, including video and longer conversations. In the meantime, keep up with my reporting at thepublicsradio.org. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you on the radio.
This is the Public Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. Rhode Island's summer tourism industry has flourished in recent years, but things are looking more uncertain this year in the wake of President Trump's new economic and border policies. How will tariffs impact spending on travel? And how will immigration policy affect international travel as well as seasonal workers? Here to help us explore those questions is Farouk Rajab. He is the CEO of the Rhode Island Hospitality Association. Farouk, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Louis. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to get your take right now. Do you think that the uncertainty about the economy and everything that's happening politically, that that could have a significant impact on the summer for Rhode Island this year?
I believe it will. And it will have, you know, a different impact on different communities. The center of the state market is heavily impacted by this uncertainty. They're seeing a very soft summer from future booking, a lot of cancellations on the corporate travel and conference travel. So that has been hit the hardest in Providence and the surrounding area. The Newport market, Middletown market, is seeing a short-term booking window. So leisure is still there, is still going to our great communities in Newport and Middletown and the surrounding area. But that window of booking is becoming shorter and shorter. So they will look at their books for next week and they wouldn't have a full occupancy on the books. But then 2-3 days prior to that arrival day, they sell out. But they're selling out at a shorter window, a lower average daily rate, which is impacting their overall profitability.
I'm wondering how the supply chain pressures that were prompted by the Trump administration's tariff policy, how that's been impacting, like, for example, restaurants or other businesses that, you know, depend so much on getting that supply, whatever it may be. How is that impacting them right now? What are you hearing?
So, fun fact of the day, Louis, 70% of seafood that we sell in Rhode Island is actually imported. So we cannot catch enough seafood in our great state of Rhode Island to supply the entire chain of restaurants. And then we don't have everything. Like, we don't have shrimp, right? Shrimp is an imported product from Thailand, from Asia, right? And that tariff went up to 78%, I believe, on Thailand at one point. And then the uncertainty. So the importers of shrimp into the state, you know, they can't sell the future. So your price is here today. Call it $10 a pound. Tomorrow it could be at $15 or it could be at $20 a pound. And then you have restaurateurs, Louis, that write menus, price it based on the price of shrimp today. Then they go print those menus. Then they go program their point of sale system to sell at that price. And then they educate their team and they write recipes based on that price. And the minute you change that price, everything we just talked about collapses. That's one simple example of what it means to play Russian roulette with taxation on imports.
So we're talking about supply there. Let's look at workers, because Rhode Island also has relied on foreign workers who obtained the visas to come here during the summer months. And I'm wondering, again, with the Trump administration's immigration policies, how that's impacted labor and that workforce. What are you hearing?
I'll take you back to Newport, for example. Newport, the 650 J-1 visa workers work in Newport during the summer. Our embassies abroad are saying, open your social media accounts. If your social media accounts are private, you're not allowed to travel to the United States of America. Apply in advance by 4 months. If you ever gave a political opinion that we don't agree with, we're not going to issue you a visa. The amount of scrutiny. Like, listen, I believe in safety and, you know, we don't want to bring the wrong people into our country. But at the same time, you're making it so difficult even for, like, the people are, like, they can go work somewhere else. These kids can go work in Switzerland, in France, in Italy, in Germany. It's difficult.
So I'm wondering, like, what hotel owners, restaurateurs, what are they doing? You know, what are they doing if they're not getting those workers? What happens?
Hoteliers are putting rooms offline, so they can't sell them. Restaurant owners could be, they have to be creative. They have to close sections. They might resort to changing hours. I was talking to a restaurant operator yesterday on a different topic. She was telling me how much they're struggling in Providence and how many covers they're doing. And this is a very excellent restaurant, right? And they're doing 30 covers a night. 30 covers a night. That doesn't keep the lights on. I talked to another restaurant operators in Providence who said to me, oh, now we are going to start closing on Wednesdays in the summer And we're hoping that the customer that is going to come on Wednesday will shift their pattern to come on a Tuesday or a Thursday. We still capture that customer, but we're trying to save our costs by closing Wednesday and trying to shift that pattern to Tuesday plus Thursday. I know a hotel GM that runs one of the greatest, biggest hotels in Newport who cleans rooms in the summer. Like, he's literally running a $40, $50 million operation and goes in and cleans rooms.
The other big thing too, Rhode Island depends so much on Canadian vacationers. And look, the relationship between the U.S. and Canada right now has definitely been tested. What are you hearing from hotel owners and resorts? Are they seeing a lot of cancellations? Are Canadians not coming down?
Canadians are very systematic and very like creatures of habit. They will go to Rhode Island because that's what they know. That's where they vacation every year. And this year, we have seen a lot less Canadians come to Rhode Island. They're creatures of habit, but now they're not feeling welcomed.
So everything you've told me, should we be concerned or optimistic in any way? What are you thinking about this summer season?
I think it will be okay in South County and Newport County. I don't think it'll be okay in Providence. I think Providence will be struggling this summer. Government travel, corporate travel, and conferences. Those three segments of travel that fuel that economic engine called hospitality in the center of the state is slowing down. Listen, if we don't have consistent water fires, those weekends become very difficult in Providence. You know, Lewis, I'm really worried about not just the summer season. I'm worried about next year. Next year is the World Cup. We're going to have so many games, so many travelers that should come into the country. Are we going to issue visas to those fans? Are we going to welcome them? Are we going to be able to host them? Because I'll tell you, a lot of hoteliers invested millions of dollars to up their game and it get their properties ready to host the World Cup in 2026. And what is going to happen to travel in 2026? What keeps me up at night?
I've been speaking with Farouk Rajab, CEO of the Rhode Island Hospitality Association. Farouk, thank you so much. I really appreciate the insight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch after this break.
What questions do you have about the Washington Bridge? What do you want to know, and what questions do you have for public officials? Rhode Island PBS and the Publix Radio are answering your questions about the bridge as part of Breaking Point, a community-centered project that is guided by what we hear from you. Give us your questions and find some answers at thepublixradio.org/breakingpoint. That's thepublixradio.org/breakingpoint.
This is the Publix Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. On July 5th, Cape Verde marks 50 years of independence. It's an important anniversary for the thousands of Cape Verdeans who will be celebrating in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, which together are home to the largest population of Cape Verdeans in the country. Joining me now to talk about this moment are two people from the region who are being honored at the national celebration in Washington, D.C. Dr. Amina Fernandez-Pilgrim is a visual artist, community organizer, and associate professor of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. Dr. Amina, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Providence native Sarah Montero, an entrepreneur, artist, and URI alum who will be performing at the 50th anniversary celebration again in D.C. Sarah, thank you for your time today.
So happy to be with you guys.
Dr. Amina, if I may ask just briefly, for people who may not know, but this independence came, I believe, after the Carnation Revolution in Portugal. Can you just help us understand what was happening right before July 5th, 1975?
You know, for several years leading up to 1975, the anti-Portuguese colonial war was waged by this group of activists, intellectuals, you know, farmers, teachers, poets, musicians, who really had a vision for a way out of the Portuguese fascism that was plaguing the country along with you know, climate change and drought and famine that was killing hundreds of thousands of people. So leading up to that moment was a really powerful saga, a drama that took place, you know, across two countries, Guinea-Bissau and Cabo Verde, and represented one of the most powerful revolutions. Cabral was able to unite many, many different people speaking many different tribal languages, worshiping different gods, people from Guinea-Bissau, as well as people from Cabo Verde, and to do so in a way that inspired many, many different people all over the continent.
Something fascinating about this, Sarah, is that celebrating American independence, no one has a living relative who was there to tell us what happened, but with your independence, Cape Verde independence, you have living relatives who could tell you what happened beforehand. You have those stories.
I do. And I'm making my life goal to collect as many of them possible. I think like the 50th is a time for Cape Verdeans to start talking about the silent sufferings that happened, the sharecropping happened in Cape Verde, for us to say that we were raped. And that there is a lot of colorism and a lot of separatism between us made and manufactured by our colonizers. And so the 50th to me is a call very much like Bob made when he asked for mental emancipation. The 50th very much is a call when Fela and everybody else asked for Africa to unite. Cabral very, very uniquely liberated two countries at the same time. Like, I don't know that we've seen that BOGO deal in world history, right? And so there is so much to uncover. Like, Cape Verdeans are going to have to be their own archaeologists to go back, and because we do have immaculate records. What we do know about slavery globally is that records were kept. And so for me, it's Cape Verdeans embracing that identity, going back home and getting to know your stories. And I am collecting those stories and I am telling them through photography, through poetry, and through different mediums.
Such a beautiful day and so much to celebrate. And then unfortunately, there are these moments, you know, and I'm thinking about the one actually that just happened this week, a Lincoln man caught on camera vandalizing a Cape Verdean flag outside of East Providence City Hall. And he was caught. He had a knife and a Nazi flag. And I'm wondering from both of you, Sarah, I'll start with you. What does this incident signal to you about the current state of discrimination and racism still towards Cape Verdeans in the U.S.? Your reaction to what happened?
I will just loudly say it for the whole world to say that the enemy has never overwhelmed me. I'm underwhelmed by the stupidity in 2025. There is a time that we could have said, hey, certain decisions were made because people didn't know better. But we have enough information to know better now. And so when I see those forms of attempts of disrespect, I almost find them laughable to a certain degree. And I say this with a grain of salt, right? I live by the sayings that Jamaicans say, which is, if the madman makes you mad, you madder than the madman, you know. We are focused on our independence. We are focused on freedom. We are focused on celebration. And there is nobody that can take that focus from us. The bill has been paid and the tip was high. There is no more explaining. And so I hope he got his tantrum out of his body. I hope that it cost him a lot. But for my people, it's not moving us. And super grateful for law enforcement just taking the actions that they needed to take. But I say we not give him too much time.
Dr. Amina, please, I give you the chance to speak up about this.
Well, coming on this platform with a poet is a challenge and an honor. Sarah spoke so powerfully about this moment. But for me, as a cultural historian, I think about echoes that this moment has in the past. I grew up in Onset, Mass., which was known as Jungle Town. And it was called Jungle Town by folks in the media who obviously, you know, had racist leanings and were thinking about stereotypes of the the African continent. In Onset, you know, there were many, many moments that were similar, like the one that just happened in Lincoln. So what I'm getting at is that Cape Verdeans throughout the diaspora have always faced, you know, systemic racism, the same kind of anti-Blackness that has plagued so many different people, melanated people. So this is just one recent moment, but I think it should make us think about the long history of struggle that we faced.
I've been speaking with Dr. Amina Fernandez-Pilgrim, a visual artist, community organizer, and associate professor of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. Also joining us was Providence native Sarah Montero, entrepreneur, artist, and URI alum. Both are going to be part of a national event in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, celebrating 50 years of Cape Verdean independence. Dr. Amina and Sarah, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
There are several local celebrations this weekend as well. Those include a parade in New Bedford's Buttonwood Park on Saturday, July 5th, starting at 11 a.m., and the 50th Annual Cape Verdean Independence Festival in Providence's India Point Park, starting at noon on Sunday, July 6th. You can find more information on our website at thepublicsradio.org. Artscape producer James Baumgartner joins me now with a few recommendations for the week ahead. James, what's going on?
Well, most of the fireworks displays in Rhode Island have already happened earlier this week, but Newport will have their fireworks show on the 4th in Fort Adams State Park. There's live music starting at 6 p.m. and the fireworks start at 9:15. You can see fireworks of a different sort at Waterfire in Providence. There will be a full 4th of July Waterfire lighting tonight downtown. And if you want football with your fireworks, there'll be a display after the Rhode Island FC match on Saturday night. The soccer game at Centerville Bank Stadium in Pawtucket begins at 7, with the fireworks shortly after the game. Newport Classical gets their season started with a free outdoor concert tonight. It's called Patriotic Pops. The Fenway Brass Quintet will play in King Park, and you can bring a picnic blanket or lawn chairs and enjoy the music and the view of the Newport Pell Bridge. The concert starts at 8 p.m. tonight. And there's another Newport Classical concert coming up next week. Third Coast Percussion is playing at the Breakers on Thursday, July 10th. They'll play classics by Steve Reich and Philip Glass, as well as some newer works on marimba, vibraphone, and all sorts of percussion instruments. That's on Thursday, July 10th at 8 o'clock.
Feeling very patriotic. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Lewis.
Before we end our show, Congress could strip already approved federal funding for public media as early as next week. If you value The Weekly Catch and everything you hear on the Public's Radio, now's the time to show your support. You could do that by making a financial donation, and you can learn more about ways to take action at protectmypublicmedia.org. That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of the Public's Radio. Our assistant producer is Joe Tasca. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our editor is Marie Valindo. Our chief content officer, Sally Isley. President and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.